Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, John Dunford. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1223, we present three more stories from new Life Rattle writer Michael Zangalla. Tonight's writer, Michael Zangalla, was born in 1991 in Oakville, Ontario, to Polish parents. He has lived in Oakville his entire life. Michael is currently in his final year of undergraduate study at university, taking biology and chemistry, and hopes to one day make it to medical school. Apart from writing, Michael enjoys drawing, soccer, tennis and golf, and spending time with his 19 and 4-year-old sisters and his friends. The stories you will hear tonight are deceptively simple. Michael skillfully notes details and observations of people and landscapes that reveal a lot more is going on than it may first appear. Tonight's first story, We'll Play Halo in a Sec, is a hilarious account of a high school friend who invites Michael over to his house to play the latest, newest edition of the video game Halo. Let's listen now as Michael Zangalla reads the story, We'll Play Halo in a Sec, tonight on Life Rattle.
We'll Play Halo in a Sec by Michael Zangalla. Ring, 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 ring. Hello? Hi, it's Michael Zangalla calling. Is Aaron there, please? Oh, hi, Mikel. How are you? I haven't heard from you in... Grandma, get off the phone! Yo, what's up, Zingal? Come over. I just got Halo 3. It's so sick. We'll play it. I'll shit-kick ya. Are you kidding? I'm on my way. The wheels of the royal blue Dodge Caravan hug the curb in front of Aaron's house. I put the van in park, step out onto the road, zip up my windbreaker, and scurry to the front door. Mom moves from the passenger seat to the driver's seat and pulls away. Knock, knock. Gabby, Aaron's golden retriever, yelps and impatiently sniffs the door. Come in, Aaron yells. I open the door, and Gabby's paws strangle my abdomen. I run my fingers under her ears, and Gabby pants with her tongue hanging out. Her breath reeks of sour milk and fried chicken. I place my black Reebok runners on the doormat and hang my coat on the staircase railing. The couch in the family room sits empty, but the TV's on, and a bucket of KFC sits on the coffee table. An Xbox lies below the TV, and a Halo 3 case sits on top. I spot an Xbox controller under the coffee table, go to pick it up, and plop down on the olive green corduroy couch. Footsteps shake the ceiling, and then the elliptical staircase. Aaron flies down the stairs 2 steps at a time. His gray sweatpants and oversized Canadiens jersey struggle to keep up with him. The floor trembles as Aaron jumps off of the last step. Yo, what's up, Zingal? Aaron pants. His cowlick and thick eyebrows border his sweaty forehead. Nothing much, man. I'm ready to play Halo. I read it got great reviews, I say. Yeah, it's so fun. You should get it. We'll play in a sec. I'll shit-kick ya. I want to show you something first, though. I follow Aaron upstairs. His right hand pushes off the railing and propels him up the steps. Scabs cover every knuckle on his right hand. Aaron disappears into his bedroom. A fist-sized hole breaks the olive-green drywall between Aaron's bedroom and his parents' bedroom. Not again, I think to myself. I enter Aaron's room and nearly stumble over the sea of clothes that swamp the floor. Posters of Jessica Alba and Jennifer Aniston line the head of Aaron's queen-size bed. Posters of every movie played in theaters over the past 2 years take up the remaining space on the walls. He works at Famous Players. Aaron emerges from his closet and tosses me a Mickey of Captain Morgan spiced rum. "How in the world did you get this?" I ask. "You know my MILF neighbor?" "Yeah, well, she always leaves her front door unlocked when she goes somewhere, and just before you came I saw her leaving. So I ran inside and grabbed it from the bar. It was the craziest thing I've ever done." I shake my head and smile. "There is something seriously wrong with you." I throw the Mickey back to Aaron. He opens it, takes a mouthful, and places it back in his closet. Aaron grabs a t-shirt from the floor and wipes his forehead with it. On the way out of his room, he points to the hole in the wall, shows me his fist, raises his eyebrows, and smiles. My mom was being such a bitch in the morning, I couldn't help it. "Give me one sec, I'll be right down." He walks into his parents' bedroom, and I head downstairs. I enter the family room, grab the Xbox controller, and retain my spot on the couch. Gabby lies on her side by the doormat. She sniffs my Reeboks and her tail wags gently. Aaron runs down the steps. His pocket jingles. "Yo, Zingal, let's go grab some food. We'll play Halo when you get back. I'll shit-kick you then." I turn the TV off and head for the door. I throw on my coat and slip on my Reebok runners. Aaron forces his feet into his worn-out Nike high tops and grabs his Canadian's toque from the closet. Aaron's grandma shouts for him from the basement. He closes his eyes, inhales through his nostrils, and yells, "Grandma, shut the fuck up! Me and Zingal are going out for a bit. We'll be back soon. Sorry for swearing, Grandma. I love you. Mwah!" Aaron kisses the air. We head out the door. The wind howls through the trees, and our shoes splash the rain on the interlock. Aaron marches to the driver's door of the silver Toyota RAV4 that sits in his driveway, pulls out a set of keys, and opens the door. "Are you insane? You don't even have your G1 yet. Do you know how much shit we can get in?" I say. "Zingal, relax, I've done this before. My rents don't get home till 7 anyways. Hop in. We're just going to McDick's and coming right back. Then I'll shit-kick you on Halo," Aaron replies. I get in and pray that the neighbors don't see us. The clock on the dashboard reads 5:41 p.m. Aaron tunes the radio from Star 102.5 to Z103.5, cranks the volume, and rolls down his window. The Drive at 5 street mix plays as we race down Dorval Drive to McDonald's. The speed limit is 60. Aaron pushes 80. Aaron pulls into the drive-thru and orders the usual, supersized Big Mac combo. I'm not hungry. We stop at the Petro Canada on the corner of Dorval Drive and Kerr Street on our way back. Aaron tanks up $5 worth of gas. "Can't let the rents know we've been driving this thing," he says. "Let's go eat at Dilsap's house. His rents are at work, so they won't see the car." Aaron starts the RAV4, and we drive to our friend Dave's house. At 6:45 p.m., Aaron and I leave Dave's house and rush back to Aaron's house. Aaron pulls the RAV4 into the empty driveway. I turn down the volume and tune back to Star 102.5 before he turns off the car. We bolt inside. Aaron kicks off his wet Nikes, chucks his toque into the closet, and dashes upstairs. I place my Reeboks on the doormat and hang my coat on the railing. Gabby follows me into the room where I grab the Xbox controller and plop down on the couch. Aaron sprints down the steps and into the family room. He grabs the remote and turns on the TV. CBC appears on the screen, where the Boston Bruins get set to play the Montreal Canadiens. Aaron's eyes widen. "Oh yeah, I forgot the Canadiens are playing tonight," Aaron says. "Zingal, don't worry. We'll play Halo in a sec. I'll shit-kick you then. Aaron buries himself into the couch, and we watch the hockey game.
That was Michael Zangalla reading his story, We'll Play Halo in a Sec. Tonight's second story, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks, takes place in a hospital in Oakville, where Michael is an admissions volunteer. He helps an elderly woman accompanying her husband. Let's listen now as Michael Zangalla reads his story, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks.
Mr. and Mrs. Brooks by Michael Zangalla. I slip my arms through the holes of my green volunteer vest and stroll past the visitor exit gate towards the front doors of the Oakville-Trafalgar Memorial Hospital. I take a deep breath of the cool morning air. In the patient drop-off circle, to the left of the front doors, an elderly man struggles to step out of a yellow cab. A bony elderly woman in a white dress, pink cardigan, and white bucket hat holds the man's left arm and helps him stand up. The man adjusts his khaki pants and corduroy cap and grabs his walker. She pays the cab driver, closes the passenger door, and adjusts the collar of the man's yellow polo shirt. I enter the hospital, sanitize my hands, and check my watch. 7:55 a.m. I sign into the room behind the front desk, take the stairs up to the second floor, and pace down the corridor towards the surgical daycare visitor's waiting room. Good morning, Michael. Are you ready for your first day volunteering by yourself? Asks Amanda, one of the nurses. Her tired eyes force a smile, and she runs her hands through her ruffled, blonde hair. I hope so, I say. Well, you'll be busy with cataracts and cysto patients today. The surgeries are routine and usually don't take more than 20 minutes, so patients will be coming in and out. It's always like this on Mondays. If you have any problems, you can ask me or any one of the nurses across the hall. Thanks, Amanda, I say. She struts out of the room. I ease into the swivel chair that rests behind the admissions desk, tuck my legs under the desk, and grab today's patient surgery list that lies on top. Pen streaks run through three names on the list. Two cataracts patients and one cystoscopy patient have already had surgery today. I search for the patient scheduled to come in next, Mr. Brooks. I pull a plastic bag out of the desk drawer and write Brooks on it with a black Sharpie. The elderly couple I saw outside the hospital enters the room. Why, hello there. Here for surgery today? I ask. You got it, the man replies. He shuffles to the desk I sit at. The elderly woman takes the man's cap off his head, grasps his shaky left arm, and shuffles beside him. Perfect. Can I have your last name, please, sir? Brooks. I'm here to see good old Dr. Casey for my third cystoscopy in 3 months. Things don't seem to be functioning down there anymore, he says. I chuckle. Who will be picking you up today, Mr. Brooks? I will be. Mrs. Brooks, his wife. Mrs. Brooks stutters. I will be staying here the whole time. She smiles at her husband, and her grasp tightens. Mr. Brooks smiles back. Great. I've already made a bag for you to put your clothes in after you change in the change room across the hall, Mr. Brooks. I can take you there now and tell you what pieces of clothing to take off and what to put on. Can I be with him until he goes into surgery this time? Mrs. Brooks asks. Sure. I think that should be okay, I respond. Mrs. Brooks's beady eyes widen behind her thick, round glasses, and she grins. I guide Mr. and Mrs. Brooks across the hall and into the change room. Mr. Brooks changes into a blue gown while Mrs. Brooks waits outside his change booth and fiddles with his cap in her hands. Mr. Brooks comes out with a bag full of clothes, and I place the bag into a nearby locker. Okay, Mr. Brooks, I'll take you to Dr. Casey's waiting room. Unfortunately, Mr. Brooks has to go alone, Mrs. Brooks, I say. She clutches his hand. I'll be waiting across the hall if you need anything, honey. I love you, Mrs. Brooks says. She smiles, leans towards Mr. Brooks, and kisses him on the cheek. Her hands tremble. I'll see you soon, sugar, replies Mr. Brooks. I escort Mr. Brooks to the cystoscopy waiting room. Hanging skin dangles from his neck, and he moves systematically with his walker. Push the walker forward, step with the right foot, then with the left. Mrs. Brooks returns to the visitor's waiting room when she can no longer see Mr. Brooks. I enter the visitor's waiting room and return to my desk. It is 8:17 a.m. Mrs. Brooks sits on the edge of the chair beside my desk and stares at the clock. Her hanging nose shades a thin, white mustache that lines her upper lip, and her cheeks sag like a bloodhound's. She fiddles with Mr. Brooks's cap. Would you like to watch something on TV, Mrs. Brooks? I ask. Startled by my question, Mrs. Brooks kindly responds, That would be nice, thank you. Anything will do. I grab the remote from the desk drawer, turn on the TV, and change the channel to City Pulse News. Mrs. Brooks eases into her chair and focuses on the TV set. An elderly cataracts patient enters the room. I write down the man's contact information, write his last name on a bag, guide him across the hall, tell him what to take off and put on, and ask him to sit in the nurse's waiting room until a nurse calls him in for surgery. I return to the visitor's waiting room and take my seat at the desk. It is 8:31 a.m. The scent of mothballs and stale perfume fills my nostrils. Mrs. Brooks stares at the clock, holds a handkerchief, hums hallelujah, and sniffles. Her large glasses accentuate severe crow's feet. I grab my Sharpie and make bags for the next 10 patients to come in for surgery today. The clock reads 8:36 a.m. I hear the change room door open across the hall. Thump, step, step. Thump, step, step. Mrs. Brooks's eyebrows shoot up and her eyes shift to the door. Mr. Brooks shuffles into the room and smiles at Mrs. Brooks. His collar sticks up. That was quick, he says. Mrs. Brooks springs from her seat and scurries over to Mr. Brooks. Oh, how was it, honey? Did everything go well? She fixes Mr. Brooks's collar and fits his cap on his head. All went well, sugar. I'm a little lightheaded, but I should be fine. Let's head downstairs and call a cab. Thanks for everything, kiddo, Mr. Brooks says. No problem, I say. Hopefully I won't see you here anymore. Mr. Brooks smiles, and Mrs. Brooks clutches onto his left arm. She snuggles up to him, and they walk out of the door, and I cross Mr. Brooks's name off of the patient's surgery list.
That was Michael Zingala reading his story, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks. Tonight's final story is a behind-the-scenes look at the Cloak and Dagger episode in which three promising hockey brothers from then-communist Slovakia are whisked away from their team in Vienna. Their destination? Canada and the NHL. Let's listen now as Michael Zingala reads his story, Pursuit in Vienna.
Pursuit in Vienna by Michael Zingala. I enter Gilles Leger's office on a cloudless Sunday morning and sit on the stool in front of his mahogany pedestal desk. Framed pictures of hockey teams, hockey players, and certificates of achievement plaster the maroon office walls. Official NHL record books and news media guides dating back to 1979 cram an eight-shelf bookcase to the right of Mr. Leger's desk. Briefcases and stacks of hockey books take up most of the space on the floor. A narrow beam of sunlight shines through open blinds to my left and focuses on a large painting of Anton, Peter, and Marion Stastny on the wall above Mr. Leger's leather office chair. The three Stastny brothers lean against the hockey net and smile in their Quebec Nordiques uniforms. Mr. Leger saunters into his office. Bags swell under his heavy eyelids, and sagging cheeks accentuate his large ears. He wears a New York Rangers cap and fleece sweater, and holds a New York Rangers coffee mug. Mr. Leger is a professional scout for the New York Rangers hockey club. He places his steaming mug of coffee on his desk and slumps into his chair. The chair emits a long sigh. He smiles. "Okay, so what do you want to know about me?" Mr. Leger asks. He grabs a toothpick from a bowl of toothpicks that lies on his desk, tosses it into his mouth, reclines in his chair, and clasps his hands on his head. "Well, from what my dad tells me, your story about bringing the Stastny brothers to Quebec is interesting. Would you mind telling me about it?" I ask with a pencil in hand and notepad on lap. Mr. Leger swivels his toothpick around his plump bottom lip. "Ah, yes, your dad liked that one," he says. "Well, to begin, the Stastny brothers were remarkable Slovakian hockey players. There was three of them, Anton, Peter, and Marian. I scouted them in 76 and drafted Anton, the youngest brother, in 79 when I was assistant manager of the Quebec Nordiques. Peter and Marian were free agents, so they could sign with any team. But as long as I had Anton, I knew Peter and Marian would play for my team. All three brothers played on the same line. They were inseparable. I tried getting the brothers to come to Quebec once I drafted Anton, but it took them a year before they agreed to come. Boy, I still remember the day Peter called me." Mr. Leger takes off his cap, runs his hand through his thinning gray hair, and gazes at the steam rising from his coffee. He chews on his toothpick. It was August 21st, 1980, at 11:04 a.m. I was in my office at the Quebec Nordiques clubhouse. Peter called me from a payphone in Innsbruck, Austria, an hour before his hockey game. In broken English, he said, "Do you have interest? We are prepared." I nearly pissed myself with joy. I knew these guys would be huge in the NHL. I got off the phone with Peter, went straight to the president of the Nordiques, Marcel Aubut, a husky man with thick, round glasses, and told him the news. That night, we booked a flight and left for Innsbruck the next morning. From then on, it became pretty traumatic. I had to work out a plan on short notice to get the Stastnys out of Austria. And, you know, back then you couldn't just leave. The Iron Curtain was in. It's not like today where crossing borders is easy. We had a serious problem on our hands. Marcel and I landed in Innsbruck at 2 p.m. I had written the number of the hotel room the Stastnys stayed at when I was on the phone with Peter, and we met briefly with the brothers before their hockey game. I had to make sure the phone call I got wasn't a joke. We spoke through an interpreter. I couldn't speak Czech. I told the brothers I had to finalize their immigration papers at the Canadian Embassy in Vienna, and that they would meet us in Vienna after their hockey game that night. Marcel and I drove to Vienna at 3 p.m. I booked two suites at the Intercontinental, one for Marcel and one for myself. I booked them under fake names so no one could track us, and it's a good thing I did. Two Czech officials followed us to Vienna. They knew what we were up to, and they weren't about to let their best player slip out of the country. In Vienna, I arranged for a special agent to escort the Stasnys from Innsbruck to Vienna after their game. The agent waited behind their hotel in a black Mercedes-Benz with tinted windows. Anton and Peter got off their team bus at around 11 p.m., grabbed their belongings, said goodbye to Marion, snuck around the back of the hotel, and hopped into the Mercedes. Marion had a family in Czechoslovakia, so he didn't leave. He came to Quebec a year later, though. The two Stasnys arrived at the Intercontinental at around 5 a.m. and slept in Marcel's suite. Mr. Leger leans forward, grabs his mug of coffee, and with the toothpick still in his mouth, takes a sip. Sunlight reflects off framed pictures on the wall and lights up the room. Mr. Leger places both hands on the sides of his mug and reclines in his chair. That morning, Marcel and I were about to leave the Intercontinental to drive to the Canadian Embassy, when I spotted the two Czech officials that had followed us. They stood outside the front doors of the hotel. We were in the lobby. They were both lean men with strong jawlines and crooked noses. One wore a black trench coat, a black fedora, and black sunglasses. The other one wore a brown trench coat and a beige scarf and held a gun. Luckily, I spotted them before they spotted us. Marcel and I snuck out the back of the hotel, rushed to our Mercedes, and sped to the embassy. I had a map on how to get there, but my hand shook so much that I couldn't read it. The roads twisted and turned and twisted and turned, and we had no idea where we were driving. I had to come up with a fast solution. I saw a cab parked next to a coffee shop. We pulled over, and I told the cab driver to lead us to the Canadian Embassy. We arrived at the embassy and met with another one of my special agents. This agent was an expert in our type of evasion, and she helped us finalize the Stasnys' immigration papers. She then drove to a police station and had two policemen escort her to the Intercontinental to pick up the Stasnys. The Stasnys snuck out the back of their hotel and got into the police car. They arrived at the embassy at around noon, and we packed their belongings into our Mercedes. The Stasnys, Marcel, and I left the embassy at around 12:10 p.m., raced to the airport, and got onto the plane back to Quebec. My agent later told me that 10 minutes after we left the embassy, the Czech officials showed up. What they did once they got there, I don't know. And to be honest, I didn't care what they did once they got there. I had the Stasnys, and that's all that mattered.
That was Michael Zangala reading his story, Pursuit in Vienna. That concludes Life Rattle number 1223. My name is John Dunford. Lori Callas recorded Michael Zangala's stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune into Life Rattle next Sunday at 9 to hear more new stories.